You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Kim Hahn. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, January 15th, 2019.
And apparently anything that has a list that would include the LGBTQ community is something that apparently will cause them problems in primary elections with the conservative base of their party.
Tonight, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb will give his annual State of the State address. Holcomb is expected to push the Republican-controlled state legislature to pass hate crimes legislation. We'll hear from Representative Matt Pierce of Bloomington, who sits on the Study Committee on Corrections and Criminal Code, about the likelihood of hate crimes legislation passing the legislature in this session. That interview with Representative Pierce is coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, black athletes went to war against fascism. When they returned home, the same soldiers weren't allowed on segregated basketball courts. Monroe County resident Bob Hamill tells the story of black athletes at Indiana University and the struggle to end segregation in athletics. That's coming up later in the program in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
In their first meeting of 2019, the Ellettsville Town Council elected new leadership. Brian Mobley will serve as council president and Dan Swafford will serve as vice president. Swafford has served on the town council before. He takes over Kevin Ferris's seat as Ward 4 representative. Fire Chief Mike Kornman and Town Marshal Jimmy Durnell were reappointed to their positions to cheers from a large audience that packed the meeting room. Many who spoke during public comment apparently had feared they would be letting go, saying they heard the council, quote, wanted to go in a different direction. Lieutenant Mike Stallcup with the Ellettsville Fire Department voiced support for Fire Chief Mike Kornman on behalf of the town's firemen. He pointed to Kornman's dedication and said it would be detrimental to both the fire department and the town to let him go.
I've had a week now of guys upset. We got a job to do, and the last thing we want to do is wonder who's going to be our boss. So if it's day to day, do they not have their jobs until they do something wrong? Or is it just you can change your mind next week and there's another meeting after this. Are you going to change your mind between now and then? Or is he good? You know, we need to know. You're not only messing with the community, but you're dealing with the employees of the town of Ellettsville, and it's ridiculous. I don't know what the issues are, but us as employees want to rest easy.
The council didn't address the rumor about moving in a different direction, nor did it cite specific concerns about Kornman or Durnell. But Council President Brian Mobley did move to suspend interim town manager Mike Farmer for 60 days. Farmer, who is the town's utilities manager, took on additional town manager duties when Jim Davis retired from the position. Former council president Scott Oldham questioned Mobley on the rationale behind the move.
We're going to suspend a town manager who's doing it for free for 60 days to do exactly what?
To be able to go back to the clerk like it used to be.
Clerk never had any statutory authority like what the town manager's been given. It all rested with the board. The clerk has a very set, defined legislative authority that's been given her by the state. Nothing beyond that. Now, the fact that Sandy was good enough to fill in and answer some questions occasionally, that's fantastic for her, but there was no state-level mandate whatsoever on her position to do that. The town manager was created specifically to help run the town day-to-day and have the individual department heads report to that town manager.
There is, what we had before was have liaisons for each department.
There is. We've had that mm-hmm. before, exactly.
Exactly. So I think that's what we maybe go back to review, but that's for the council to talk in executive session to see which way they want to go.
Well, I'm asking a question here because
I know.
If we're suspending a guy who's doing it for free, what are you saving? So, instead of just letting him continue to do what he's doing.
We're saving because of the information and stuff is being controlled by the town of Ellettsville.
I'm sorry?
By the clerk who controls the money and situations.
I can't hear you.
No, sorry. So what I'd like to do is see the clerk as state standard is, state policy is the clerk handles the money and the policies and procedures.
She continues to handle the money. He has nothing to do with the money, nor does he have any authority to do anything with the money beyond what this council has given him by resolution when we made the town manager position.
But she is employee of the town of Ellettsville.
No, she's an elected official. She's
she
not
gets
employee.
Paid by the town of Ellettsville.
She's an elected official. She is not an employee.
Exactly.
There's
but
a
she gets money. Does she get any money from the town?
Well, yeah, through his contract he does, but he's doing the town manager job for free. She is an elected official, and by law, she has certain statutory guidelines that she has to follow. Mm-hmm. Now, the fact that she's been willing to fit in a pinch here and there to do different things is what it is. But when we created the town manager position, that was specifically to alleviate a lot of those duties from her, which were dragging her and her office down. You've heard repeatedly her say that she needs help. Well, now we're going to add more job duties to her position? That just doesn't make a lot of sense, even for 60 days, when you have a guy who's been doing a fantastic job doing it for free.
Council member Scott Thomas said he was in favor of reconsidering the town manager position, but said Farmer could continue in the position while it was being reviewed.
I have heard from some employees who wanted to go back to the way it was with the liaison and have representation and have direct interaction to have a better feel of where the town wants to go.
Farmer said he took the position of interim town manager at the town council's request, but he said he didn't want to create, in his words, a house divided.
Clearly, I think the time has come when I not be the town manager anymore just because the very issue is going to divide the board. I'm here to support and sustain any initiatives or efforts that make Ellettsville a better place, and so I can do that from my position as a utilities manager and local resident.
The council found itself facing spontaneous questioning from the large audience that had gathered for the public meeting. Referring to Farmer, one unidentified audience member called out, quote, "What's the agenda behind letting him go?" Mobley did not respond, and community members continued to express their concern in a formal comment period. Local businesswoman Valerie DeWar advocated for keeping both the town manager position and Mike Farmer in it. She said Ellettsville has become a viable business community due in part to the efforts of the town manager.
You talk about transparency of governments anymore and understanding. It's nice to have one person to be able to go to who has a connection to all the department heads. At this point, I think that I'm very concerned if you're talking about doing away with the position. I think what you're I'm concerned about is a micromanagement by part-time people who have to only be able to do it on the minimal hours that they would be devoting to the town, whereas the town manager is devoting 100%.
Realtor Dan Reary also voiced his support both Farmer and the town manager position. He referred to Ellettsville's operations as a well-oiled machine.
I see no reason to change what is working well, especially change for change's sake or purely personal reasons. Now, a lot of small towns are ruled by small town politics at its worst. Petty infighting instigated by reactions to slights, real or perceived, feuds, disagreements, nepotism, patronage, good old boy politics. And I haven't seen that here for many years. It used to be like that. And I haven't seen it that way for many years. And I would hate to see us devolve into that now.
Council President Mobley did not cite any specific complaints about Farmer when requesting he be suspended for 60 days. Neither did the council address the rumors that it wanted a change of direction. Area resident William Ellis pressed the Ellettsville Town Council to alleviate the audience concerns and commit to retaining Farmer.
Because a different direction doesn't cut it with most of these people, because we're all happy with the direction it's been going. So if things stay the same with the way they're doing their jobs, will you pledge for the next year there's going to be no shenanigans and that you will keep them on in their positions? You do that, I think that'll alleviate a lot of these concerns.
Ultimately, the Ellettsville Town Council voted unanimously to keep Mike Farmer in the town manager position, though it did not specify for how long. Neither did the council say whether it would continue to consider rearranging the town's management structure in the future.
Major League Soccer team, the Indy 11, may be getting a new stadium. As WFHB correspondent Andrew McKiernan reports, taxpayers may foot the $500 million bill.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb yesterday raised the possibility of building a professional soccer stadium in Indianapolis. According to the Indianapolis Business Journal, the Indy 11 soccer team proposed on Thursday a $550 million mixed-use real estate project that would include a 20,000-seat soccer stadium. The project would also include apartments, retail, office space, a hotel, and underground parking. Indy 11 owner Ersal Ozdemir told the IBJ that he has been discussing possible locations for the development with Indianapolis and state officials. A decision has not yet been reached, but several locations in downtown Indianapolis are being considered. Governor Holcomb has not yet taken a position on the proposal, saying that he needs more details. Funding for the development would come from state tax revenue. The Indy 11 currently play in Lucas Oil Stadium, which they share with the Indianapolis Colts. Governor Holcomb will be giving his State of the State address tonight at 7. From WFHB, I'm Andrew McCarron.
State Representative Randy Fry is pursuing tighter controls over grants from the Indiana Department of Veterans Affairs. The Greensburg Republican has filed a bill that would make Veterans Affairs employees ineligible for grants from the agency's Military Family Relief Fund. The Associated Press reports the bill would also set a $2,500 cap on the amount grant recipients can receive in a lifetime. It would also put measures in place to prevent the state agency from awarding grants to applicants who have not submitted complete applications. Last November, the Indianapolis Star reported that 11 Veterans Affairs employees had been awarded grants from the Military Family Relief Fund. The fund, created in 2007, is meant to help veterans access medical services and transportation, as well as basic needs such as food, housing, and utilities. The agency's leader, James Brown, resigned last month following reports he awarded money to veterans who worked under him, including workers earning $40,000 to $50,000. Fry filed the bill in the Veterans Affairs and Public Safety Committee. As chair of that committee, he will be able to guide the bill's progress.
The United States Postal Service is requesting area residents make certain their sidewalks and porches are cleared of snow and ice. The USPS is funded independently and is not affected by the ongoing federal government shutdown, which is now the longest on record. Residents of an address, regardless of whether they rent or own, are responsible for making sure their sidewalks and porches are clear of snow and ice. The Postal Service, in a press release yesterday, has asked area residents to ensure that mail carriers can deliver packages to addresses. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Kim Hahn. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb will give his State of the State address tonight. The governor's speech is expected to instruct the state's legislature to advance hate crimes legislation. Indiana is one of five states that do not have hate crimes laws on the books. Governor Holcomb is expected to instruct fellow Republicans to author hate crimes legislation. But social conservatives have pushed back against passing hate crimes legislation. In Monroe County, the grassroots conservatives have called any attempt to pass hate crimes laws a governmental overreach and thought control. For other religious conservatives across the state, the issue of LGBTQ plus protections is a sticking point. Religious conservatives in the state legislature have signaled they will not support any hate crimes bill that includes LGBTQ plus protections. Bloomington Democratic Representative Matt Pierce was on the study committee on corrections and criminal code. That study committee was directed by Governor Holcomb to look into the passage of hate crimes legislation last year after a Carmel synagogue was vandalized with swastika graffiti. Representative Pierce speaks with WFHB News Director Wes Martin about Governor Holcomb's address tonight and the 2019 state legislative session in today's feature report.
Well, there's just a whole host of things that need to be done, I think, to get Indiana on the right track. You know, we've got the issue of properly funding our public schools, making sure that our teachers get real pay raise. Looks like a lot of what's being discussed up here at the General Assembly right now is just not really putting the money in to get the job done for this session and just kind of beating up on local school boards who have not given pay raises because we in the legislature have not given them the funding they need. And so that's going to be an interesting discussion about teacher pay and school funding in general. I hope to make another run at trying to protect the backwoods areas and other sensitive areas of our state forests. And, you know, we have to continue our progress on criminal code reform. So as you might know, we passed a major reform of Indiana's criminal code 5 or so years ago. And the whole theory is that for low-level nonviolent offenders, we want to keep them at home and put them in programs that get at their underlying causes of the crime, which are usually mental illness and substance abuse. So we want to make sure we continue on that path. We've had some pilot programs around the state that have done a very good job. They're getting excellent results, but it's time now to expand those throughout the state, which is going to take more money from the General Assembly. And so that's a big issue related to the budget. So there's just lots of issues along those lines that I'll be working on as the General Assembly progresses.
Representative Pierce, you had mentioned things like teacher pay, for example. That's definitely been a priority for Democratic lawmakers in the past. Do you see any hope for the state allocating additional funding for things like an increase in teacher salaries?
Well, from the rhetoric we've heard so far from the Republicans who control the legislature and the governor's office, it seems that they're not really willing to put the funding in place during this upcoming budget cycle. And it appears that what they're trying to do is somehow blame the local school boards and local officials for not raising teacher pay. And so they've got some bills beginning to work their way through the process that would essentially tell local school boards you're spending too much money on operations and not enough on the classroom, and therefore you need to shift more money over there, and then that theoretically would result in higher teacher pay. The problem is when you ask them to identify what are things that the schools are paying for that you think are not needed and should be shifted into direct classroom spending, they can't really give you an answer. So the question is, do you get rid of the school bus drivers who drive the kids to school? Do you get rid of the cafeteria workers who make sure that they get a good, nutritious meal during their day? Do you get rid of the guidance counselors who might be able to identify kids that are struggling and maybe have mental illness challenges that might be able to avert, you know, some kind of tragedy from occurring in the school? I mean, who do you get rid of in this supposed drive to get money into the classroom? So to me, all of that is just an attempt to shift blame and to avoid actually doing what needs to be done, which is getting our schools the funding they need to be able to operate the way they should.
Representative Pierce, tonight it's expected that Governor Holcomb will make, during his State of the State address, will make a couple of announcements with regards to encouraging lawmakers in Indiana to push for a bias crimes legislation or a hate crimes bill. As we know, Indiana is one of 5 states that doesn't have any kind of hate crimes law on the books. What is the scuttlebutt, I guess, around the state legislature when it comes to that push? In particular, I think we've seen in the past that folks in the LGBTQ plus community have been a major sticking point for some Republicans. And I'm wondering if that dialogue or that kind of conversation around hate crimes legislation may have changed given the governor's latest push.
Well, I think the governor certainly deserves credit for getting the issue of hate crimes onto the legislative agenda. And I think if he had not come forward and said it's time to get that issue resolved, that both the House and the Senate leadership would have decided to avoid the issue altogether. So certainly the governor's speaking out on the issue has got it on the agenda. What remains to be seen is how direct he will be in the debate. And whether he'll just simply say it's time to have a hate crimes bill, so let's pass something, or whether he gets more specific. Because right now what appears to be happening is because the Republican majorities appear unwilling to adopt a hate crimes bill that includes the LGBTQ community, they're trying to craft bills that are very, very general, that say things like, if you commit a crime based on the trait, characteristic, or membership of an individual, then you might have your sentence increased. The problem with that is that was tried once, I think, in Georgia, and the courts ruled that it was too vague, that you couldn't really know what was legal and what wasn't, and therefore the bill was unconstitutional. So I think they're going to have problems executing that type of thing. But I think what you see happening is the Republican majorities in the House and Senate are struggling to find a hate crimes bill that they can pass without angering their social conservative base of support. And apparently anything that has a list that would include the LGBTQ community is something that apparently will cause them problems in primary elections with the conservative base of their party. So they're trying to work around that. And so I'll be interested to see tonight whether the governor in his speech is more specific. He has seemed to have indicated he would just like to have a straight-on bill that lists the groups of people that have traditionally suffered discrimination and have that in our statute. And it'll be interesting to see whether he says that in his speech tonight and basically how forcefully he argues for that form of a bill to be passed.
Representative Pierce, what other bills or what other legislation is on the table this legislative session or should be on the table this legislative session that nobody's really paying attention to or something that you may think in particular is of importance but has been kind of neglected?
Well, there are a whole host of issues that, you know, should be addressed, which probably won't. So, for example, we have some counties that have some state funding for early childhood education, basically preschool programs. The benefits of that have been proven by research, and we ought to be moving as quickly as we can to expand that program throughout the state so every child in Indiana has the opportunity to be in a quality preschool program. That would save us a lot of money in the future, increase educational outcomes, and do a lot of great things. But because it requires an additional investment from the state, nobody on the Republican side of the aisle seems to want to talk much about that issue. So that's something that definitely needs to happen. Another issue I wish the legislature would address would be paid family and medical leave. As you know, under the federal law, people have a right to have an unpaid leave from work to take care of a sick family member or perhaps recover from a childbirth and to take care of their child for the first few months of their life. And the problem is that a lot of people cannot afford an unpaid leave. It doesn't help them at all. And there are many states now that are passing laws that are a little bit like unemployment compensation or workers' compensation, where you have a very small payroll payment into a fund that would then allow people to draw on and get some pay when they have to take a medical leave. And I think that's something that would really increase workforce productivity and help a lot of people out. But again, that's something that no one seems much interested in here, at least the people who are deciding what's on the agenda.
Coming up next, Monroe County resident Bob Hamill tells the story of Black athletes and overcoming segregation in sports in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal. looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. I'm Bob Hamill. Black soldiers fought and died for the Union Army in the Civil War, for the Allied Army in World Wars I and II. But when the last of the fighting ended in Japan in 1945, their race couldn't play the game of college basketball back home at Indiana or Purdue or anywhere else in the Big Ten or any major conference in the United States. There was, you see, this unwritten but universally observed, quote, gentleman's agreement, unquote, that these bastions of higher education would not subject their athletes to playing basketball against, you know the term. The president of one of those participating universities said in a letter he understood such a ban, quote, in a game where there is such close physical contact between players scantily clad and perspiring at every pore, unquote. It was an agreement, an abomination that had stood in the northern Midwest, well above the Mason-Dixon line, forever, but explicitly for more than 20 years. The Rosa Parks moment, when that ended, came in Bloomington in the fall of 1947 when Bill Garrett agreed to enroll at IU, and for sure on December 4, 1948, when undersized but jet-quick 6'2 center William Leon Garrett went onto the court for the game-opening tip in IU's season opener against DePauw. Oh, the agreement didn't end that day. In baseball, Jackie Robinson had to go it alone for just half a season before Larry Doby had integrated the American League and other national leagues had found room on their roster for a black player or two. Not so in college basketball. The Big Ten and major college basketball waited and watched. Bill Garrett played three full seasons at IU, left as a popular campus favorite with the school's scoring record and a diploma, and never played with or against another black player. After he had run that gauntlet without the first hint of a problem, some other Big Ten schools found room on the roster for one or two. IU added its second, and around the country, the Garrett breakthrough prompted other conferences to open, or in the case of the Pacific Coast, where Jackie Robinson himself had been a basketball star at UCLA before even that league stopped recruiting blacks, reopened their doors. Bill Garrett had led Shelbyville to what still is its only state high school basketball championship in 1947. He broke the tournament scoring record. He was named Mr. Basketball. But a similarly gifted, similarly sized center named Jumpin' Johnny Wilson had done the same thing for Anderson just a year before, and there were no scholarship offers. That was the last straw for black leaders in Indianapolis. Openly, they put pressure on IU to end that, quote, gentleman's agreement, unquote. And just as certainly, that pressure went on Purdue, and from black leaders in Detroit and Chicago and Cleveland and other municipalities across the Midwest on their own Big Ten schools. IU President Herman Wells was the one who listened, and with Bill Garrett, through Branch McCracken, made it happen. Those black leaders, Wells, McCracken, and the white faces in three archived team pictures where Bill Garrett's smile and skin color jump out were the supporting actors in this epical story. But Bill Garrett was the star. Bill Garrett was the one who walked that four-year path alone and at the end of it all had opened the doors to African-American players forever. To the everlasting enrichment of IU basketball and Big Ten basketball and college basketball and all the rest of us. That's why, on the lawn outside the old field house, the 7th Street barn that was IU's basketball home from 1930 to 1960, there's a state historical marker proclaiming that here is where true history was made December 4th, 1948. It's a moment that deserves annual observance, and not just in Bloomington.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us. For WFHB, I'm Kim Hahn.
And I'm Don Guerra.